From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Ukraine's government is showing cracks following Monday's violent clashes in Kiev that have now resulted in the deaths of three National Guard soldiers. Protests by far-right groups were sparked by a parliament vote Monday intended to give more autonomy to the embattled eastern regions. Footage of the protest shows far-right politician Oleg Tyanybok hurling insults and taking a stand on the front lines of the deadly protest, while the right-wing parties have removed themselves from the coalition government and the country's deputy prime minister has resigned. RT's Harry Fear was in Kiev Tuesday and filed this report.
We're seeing really the deepening of political tensions here in Kiev, and even one could say the development of some kind of political crisis for the ruling coalition party here. Now, after yesterday's divisive, contentious and dramatic first vote on those proposals for constitutional amendments that would give something of greater autonomy to those embattled eastern regions of the country, we have now heard the resignation of the Deputy Prime Minister of Ukraine. And to add to that today, also the announcement that the so-called Radical Party is pulling out of the ruling coalition government. Now, this could all go to ruin and destroy the integrity and viability of the ruling coalition. This is not great news for Poroshenko. Now, also development, the release of another video showing apparently a far-right ultra-nationalist party leader also involved in yesterday's violence, or at least inciting at yesterday's violence. Now, the man in Oleg Tyanybok was captured in this video as outside of the parliament rallying. Fair enough. But he's then in the video seen going on to allegedly hurl abusive language at officers and then even directly get involved in the scuffles with them. Now, this is supposedly a party political leader, so extraordinary compartment on his behalf. Now, Tyanybok was also among the leaders of the Maidan violence, and so it's noteworthy here that he's been caught up again in such clashing as well.
It's a Syrian conflict well into its fifth year. The humanitarian needs of the Syrian people are greatly outpacing the ability of aid agencies to respond. That, according to UN Humanitarian Affairs Chief Stephen O'Brien, in comments delivered to a donors' meeting in Kuwait Tuesday. He said funding shortfalls could, quote, mean the difference between life and death, closed quote. Deanne Penn reports.
The Syrian conflict has displaced nearly 8 million people inside the country and forced more than 4 million others to flee to neighbors such as Lebanon and Jordan. Mr. O'Brien said the situation only looks set to worsen if no political solution to the conflict is found. Meanwhile, humanitarian needs are growing and agencies are being forced to scale back. The UN humanitarian chief explained how the World Food Programme, WFP, has already cut food vouchers by as much as half for some displaced Syrian communities. Funding shortfalls in Syria, he added, can be the difference between life or death. Mr. O'Brien said aid agencies will continue to call for vigorous and sustained support for Syria. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
In Lebanon, riot police dispersed protesters who gathered in central Beirut to protest the lack of garbage collection and other essential services for much of the summer. The police acted after the protesters stormed the environmental ministry, demanding the resignation of its chief. The initially peaceful sit-in briefly turned violent when police forcibly removed protesters from the ministry. RT's Paula Slyer was there when the protesters went into the ministry and filed this report from the protest outside.
The situation has escalated. A group of riot police have made their way forward to the crowd behind me, and there were a number of what sounded like either stun grenades or firecrackers that were being shot off by one or both sides. Now, we are stuck on this side of a barrier, and that is because we arrived here hours ago. We're inside a government complex that houses both the Labour office as well as the Environment Ministry, and other protesters who've been trying to get through have been blocked off by the riot police, so they are preventing everybody from arriving or entering. A group of protesters were brought out of the Environment Office. Now, these were protesters who were among the first group to get in the early hours of this afternoon, and that precipitated this whole wave of violence. They were brought out, some of them in quite poor condition. I saw one man with bruises to his neck. I saw two women crying hysterically. There was one woman who was brought out on a stretcher. Clearly, the mood on the ground is extremely angry, and people here are demanding answers.
She later caught up with one of the protesters who had been inside the ministry building.
Okay, I was there. We were more than 20 or 30 protesters.
Were you inside?
Yes, I was inside. I got beaten along with the rest of my friends.
What happened?
What happened? We came at 1 p.m. to the Ministry of Ecology, Environment. And we wanted to showcase that the government won't respond to us. We gave them a 72 hours delay since Saturday, and they haven't responded to any of our demands.
And you weren't provoking the situation? No violence?
No. Au contraire, we were telling them sin mia, which means peaceful protesters. And then when the corridor was empty for them, they attacked us with their boots and with their batons.
What is the next step? Is this going to make the revolution take another step?
Well, if this doesn't make a revolution, if attacking civilians who are demanding the basic rights of protesting the whole time won't start a revolution, then I don't know. For me, hope is gone. But we're hoping that everyone would see the savagery in which this government is attacking us and shooting us, because we simply want a solution for a garbage crisis. They should resign, all of them. Monsters.
The 128-member parliament has failed to elect a new president in 26 attempts since April 2014. Parliamentary elections have been postponed twice. The government is paralyzed. The war in neighboring Syria has spilled across the border in the form of suicide bombings and rocket attacks. And Lebanon is host to the highest per capita refugee population in the world, at an official tally of 1.1 million Syrians. All the while, people are faced with daily electricity blackouts and some of the most expensive and slowest internet service in the world. Mariam Soleil, speaking from Beirut with Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli, said government paralysis, resulting from deep divisions among the political class, have left the protesters no choice but to act outside the political system.
Unfortunately, the problems that in Lebanon go way back several years, and they are very deep because the political sides are all deeply divided. And this is something that's clear in Lebanon. This is part of the complexity that we have in the country. When we go to the cabinet, this is supposed to be a national unity cabinet where you have the March 14th and March 8th coalitions together. However, they can't agree even on social issues. They don't have a clear agenda that they are working with. But we have other politicians like head of the Free Patriotic Movement, Michel Aoun, who is clearly putting down an agenda, saying that we need to first of all elect a president, electing a president from the people directly, a popular vote. He believes that this is step one to actually finding solutions to the country. And this, and after this, we have the issue of abolishing political sectarianism. That's another issue that the Speaker Biri has spoken about. So you have the politicians actually not supporting these small protesters, but of course these protesters are very significant because it's very significant that they are showing what the people are angry about. And many of the people, even the civilians, everybody at home, even those who support the political groups who are part of the government, they all are angry at what's happening. Not only the e-waste crisis, like we said, we also have electricity problems. We also have water problems.
Catherine Shakhtam is with the Beirut Center for Middle East Studies. She said that people in Lebanon want not just regime change, but systemic change, and that the unrest in Beirut could well spread throughout Lebanon.
What the people want right now is really clear. They want to change, not just in regime, but I think, you know, really they want to change the system altogether, not just the government. And I think that, you know, this is, you know, starting with, you know, the resignation of the Ministry of Environment. And I don't think they will stop until they get what they want. Now the government is very unlikely to comply, and only because they're in a corner and that they enjoy the status quo. It's an oligarchy in Lebanon. People are making a lot of money for being in a position of power. And, you know, they're not going to leave their position of power unless they're absolutely forced to. And they have the backup of, you know, a very powerful regional power, mainly Saudi Arabia. It is absolutely the right of the people to demand, you know, for political self-determination and demand that their needs and rights be met. I don't see violence, but I see more people coming down to the street, and I see, you know, a very broad movement taking place in Lebanon, and not just in Beirut. I mean, other cities could actually rise up as well.
Thursday, we'll see a massive celebration in Beijing marking the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. The military parade in Beijing, celebrating Japan's surrender, will feature some 500 units of China's military hardware rolling across Tiananmen Square, accompanied by 12,000 troops. RT's Muryad Gazdiev was in Beijing Wednesday.
We're on Tiananmen Square, the day before the big day. This is where the Victory Day parade, commemorating 70 years since World War II, will take place. 3,700 journalists have applied for accreditation to be here. That should tell you how big of a day tomorrow is going to be. 50 countries will be represented here tomorrow. High-ranking officials from 50 countries. President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, will be here. Leaders of various Asian countries, as well as the leader of South Korea, who, according to reports, was pressured, prodded, and even bullied by the United States not to attend tomorrow's parade. Parade itself is going to be giant. 500 units of military equipment will trundle down this road, watched on by all those leaders. 200 aircraft will fly overhead, and the Chinese have said that almost all of them, about 90%, will be new, never before seen.
Russia's foreign minister says Bashar Assad is the legitimate president of Syria. Sergei Lavrov said that the anti-terrorism fight in Syria can be effective only if the demands for Assad's resignation are withdrawn. Lavrov rejected the resignation call by the Syrian opposition and some other countries as a, quote, totally unrealistic and counterproductive precondition, closed quote. Lavrov said the current conflict should be brought to an end through dialogue among Syrian parties, an issue which he said was raised during his recent meeting with representatives of Syrian opposition groups in Moscow. He added that ISIL's terrorism has been the product of foreign intervention in the Middle East region. The countdown is underway in South Sudan to form a unity government after President Salva Kiir signed a regionally mediated peace deal last week.
We'll sign this document, but I warn you, you regional leaders, to stand with us in the implementation. Otherwise, we may spoil it if it is left to us. There is now fighting today, and that fighting was uncalled for. The commanders fighting in the field, what do they want to achieve? Or what do they want to show us? The message is very clear, that what we are doing here is not accepted by the other side.
Some of the region's sponsors of the deal spoke at the signing last Wednesday. This was Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta.
I know some have reservations. I will appeal to you to set aside those reservations, to look at the greater picture, to look at the people that you lead, to look at the need for peace, to look at the need for unity.
Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni was also present for the signing.
This was not a just war. It was an unjust war. It was a wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time.
CCTV's Kofi Morenja laid out some of the details of the agreement.
Museveni and Kenyatta have been working for months to get the two sides to agree to the terms of the peace deal. But just what exactly are they? Well, here are some key points. Under the treaty, fighting must stop immediately. All military forces are to leave Juba. Rebel leader Riek Machar is to return as vice president. A transitional government of national unity to take office in 90 days. Elections need to take place 60 days before the end of the transitional government's mandate. And a commission for truth, reconciliation and healing to investigate human rights violations. The international community, in the meantime, has welcomed the peace deal. The United States and European Union have welcomed the signing. The true test now, though, is seeing it implemented. Kofa Mrenje, CCTV.
Rebel leader Riek Machar had signed the deal a week earlier, but President Kiir originally refused, signing only under international pressure, primarily from the United States. The South Sudan peace deal was the subject of discussion on this week's edition of Press TV's Africa Today, whose host, Amina Taylor, discussed the heavy hand of the U.S. with her two guests, Ishaq Mekki, who chairs the Darfur Victims Organization, and journalist Hafsa Kara Mustafa.
And perhaps one of the most important statements on the South Sudan peace deal came out of the office of the National Security Advisor, Susan E. Rice. And some of this statement reads in full. I'm just going to pick some pertinent statements there for you. Says the United States welcomes President Kiir's decision to accept the terms of peace and sign the regionally sponsored peace agreement in South Sudan. Now here's the caveat. We do not recognize any reservations or addendums to that agreement. The United States believes that this is necessary as a first step towards ending the conflict and building the country. And we will work with our international partners to sideline those who stand in the way of peace, drawing upon the full range of our multilateral and bilateral tools. So essentially, Ishaq, we've given you the carrot, but we're also holding up a very big stick.
Yes, well, it is. That's what exactly it says. But then there is an element missing from one of your correspondents saying that there has been a genocide, and there is no accountability held by any parties. I think this is really not something that people of South Sudan welcome, because they in Juba itself and many parts. The two party of the generals, the army, they went randomly killing citizens and just on basis of tribe and so forth. So I think what America and the international community say that you have to take this peace deal ahead. If not, there is a stick. It's important. It doesn't work with that in African terms. They stick it, sometimes it might work, and I hope that they do it, as Mr. Rice said, that if they're not taking the peace deal ahead, then there will be a serious consequence, and that should happen.
But Hafsa, this is very, very crucial, because essentially what you're saying is we've caused the situation, it hasn't been managed particularly well, and now if you guys can't get into bed together on this, we will further cripple a country that's already crippled.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is a very menacing message from Ms. Rice, actually, because what it says, rather than actually encourage parties to accept the deal for the sake of peace, it is actually a menacing tone that's saying you have to do it or else the situation for your people will deteriorate. So basically, it's either they're dying as a result of the civil war, or they will die as a result of crippling sanctions that will worsen the economic situation. So we're having a very strange and very alarming message coming from the US. Of course, there needs to be incentive for both parties, and I think the incentive here is to tell everyone involved that this is a good deal. And I disagree with the Facebook messenger saying that no peace is good. I think when you're dying and when you're being killed and when you're suffering the brunt of war, I think any peace is deal, really. You have to stop the bloodshed first and foremost. So I disagree that any peace is wrong. But of course, the menacing tone of the US is even more alarming, because it seems to say that if you don't agree to our terms, then we'll punish you in another way. What we need to hear is that peace is necessary, because people are dying and both sides simply need to work together in order to stop the bloodshed.
South Sudan's peace agreement was on the table at the UN Security Council last Friday.
The Security Council welcomes the 26 August 2015 signature by President Salva Kiir Mayardit on the agreement on the resolution of the conflict in the Republic of South Sudan, as well as the signatures by SPLM, SPLA, IO Chairman Dr. Riek Machar Tenney, former detainees representative Mr. Pagan Amun Okiech on 17th of August 2015, and joined by other stakeholders, and recognizes these signatures as a commitment by the parties to implement the agreement as contained in the Annex S/2015-654. The Security Council expresses its concern with any statement by any party suggesting a lack of commitment to implement the agreement as contained exclusively in the Annex to S/2015-654. The Security Council acknowledges that this agreement is the first step in reversing the difficult political and economic situation and humanitarian and security catastrophe resulting from this crisis, calls upon the parties with support from the United Nations and international community to fully implement the agreement and reaffirms its unwavering support of the people of South Sudan. The Security Council notes the African Union Peace and Security Council's 24th of August 2015 press statement, warning that all those undermining the lasting resolution of the conflict, including implementation of the agreement, would be held accountable for their actions. The Security Council underscores the pressing need to ensure accountability for serious violations and abuses of human rights and serious violations of international humanitarian law. The Security Council takes note in this regard of Chapter 5 of the agreement. The Security Council further recognizes the work of the African Union Commission of Inquiry in independent and public human rights monitoring, investigation and reporting, and anticipates with interest its findings and recommendations, and encourages the public release of the final report as soon as possible on South Sudan. The Security Council renews its deep appreciation for the courageous actions taken by UNMISS personnel and troop and police contributing countries to protect hundreds of thousands of civilians under threat of physical violence and to stabilize the security situation across South Sudan.
Abiyomi Ezekwe is the editor of the Pan-African Newswire, the international daily Pan-African news service. We spoke with him via Skype from Detroit Wednesday. So you have all this activity around a peace agreement in South Sudan. Obviously, the hand of the United States in that, and even Susan Rice's rather stern warning to the president of South Sudan. He was their guy, though, right?
Most definitely. And the United States backed the partition of the Republic of Sudan, which prior to 2011 was the largest geographic nation state in Africa. It was an oil-producing, emerging state. Economic development was taking place at a fairly accelerated level. With this partition, both the Republic of Sudan in the north as well as the Republic of South Sudan have been severely damaged. And, of course, with the unsustainability of the Republic of South Sudan being revealed by this split between Riek Machar, the former vice president, and the current president, Salva Kiir, it shows that the U.S. definitely has a problem. That's why they're so heavily involved. And this is why they're threatening sanctions against the Salva Kiir government if they do not adhere to the ceasefire agreement.
Was the breakoff of South Sudan similar to like the breakoff of Katanga back in the early 60s in Congo because of the oil wealth in this particular case?
Well, there are some differences. Sudan was a British colony. The way in which it was governed, the north of the country was completely split off from the south. And there was very little interaction between the two major regions inside the country. And then with the discovery of oil and the beginning of an oil industry inside the country in both the north as well as the south, This, of course, was coveted in terms of the control of the oil resources by U.S. and other Western-based petroleum corporations. Now, the Republic of Sudan, headed by Omar Hassan al-Bashir, has signed numerous agreements with the People's Republic of China, as well as other Middle Eastern nations and Asian nations. 80% of the oil concessions in the Republic of Sudan up to the time of the partition were in control by the People's Republic of China. So this is another way in which the United States utilized the divisions between the North and the South, which are a part of the legacy of British imperialism, to in fact try to get into the burgeoning oil industry inside the Republic of South Sudan. But now both South Sudan and the Republic of Sudan have relations with the People's Republic of China. So there's the oil factor, and also the factor that Sudan at that time did not go along with a lot of the U.S. Foreign policy imperatives, for example, in Iraq. So this has been a major problem, you know, as far as they're concerned.
Hmm. I'm wondering also, since you had at least a period of a few years where the People's Republic of China is engaging with Sudan and the United States is engaging with South Sudan, it's an opportunity to, at least in a small scale, to look at the differences between what those two competing models offer to countries in the South. Are there any differences with the way China's treated Sudan, with the way the U.S. has treated the South?
Yes. According to many Africans on the continent, both in government and outside of government, the type of agreements that have been signed and implemented between China and various African Union member states has been markedly and qualitatively different than what they have with the United States. And we saw evidence of that recently when Obama went to East Africa. He went to Kenya, where he hosted an entrepreneurial summit that was sponsored by the United States, and also when he went to Ethiopia. Now, when he was in Kenya, he was lecturing the people in Kenya that they have to stay away from corruption, that they have to respect human rights. But of course, if they were prepared and in a position to do so, they should have asked him, you know, what about all the African Americans that are being killed by the police, who are being driven out of the cities, who are dying in detention, the rebellions that are going on in Ferguson and in St. Louis and in Baltimore, the mass demonstrations against racism and increasing poverty and all of this inside the United States. So it's a contradiction in that regard. When he was in Ethiopia, he was given the same speech, essentially. But at the same time, the same African Union Conference Center where he was speaking was built by the Chinese. So they are, in fact, making tremendous headway. They're the largest trading partner now with the AU member states, that is Beijing. And the United States is running, trying to catch up. But their main influence now is, of course, through military affairs and intelligence with the United States Africa Command, the escalation of CIA and State Department personnel, particularly in East Africa, is striking. So they're using their military and intelligence apparatus to counter China's economic relations with Africa.
Okay, and finally, in the short term at least, how do you see the fortunes of this particular peace agreement playing out?
Well, it depends. There have been agreements before, and they've been broken. There's a serious problem, of course, between Machar and Kiir. So it remains to be seen whether or not this agreement will hold. You also have the intervention of Uganda, which still has troops in South Sudan in support of the current president there, and working out agreements based upon the political control of the state and the holding of elections is always a very, very difficult situation. So we'll have to see how it plays out. But if it erupts or worsens, it could have regional implications with the involvement of Uganda and also the actual Republic of Sudan as well, since there are two countries now, as well as refugees who are fleeing to neighboring states in fear of their lives.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.